And good afternoon, and welcome to Lambda Weekly. I'm David Taffet, and I'm alone so far today. Well, not quite alone. I have somebody in the studio with me. I have Jesse Garcia. Jesse's going to be doing a new show here on KNON, and he's just watching me do the board. Our guest today is on the phone. She's calling us from Atlanta. Her name is Dr. Glenda Corwin. She's a clinical psychologist who's been in private practice for 20 years. She specializes in sexual intimacy issues for women in same-sex relationships. And Glenda, can you hear me?
I sure can. Hello.
Good. Now, I do have to warn you, all of my friends who saw this was the topic said, oh, so this is going to be the most immature interview that you've done in 20 years, right? But I read the book. I actually did go through the book. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
And what I found was that the title of the book could be Sexual Intimacy, rather than Sexual Intimacy for Women, a Guide for Same-Sex Couples, it could just be Sexual Intimacy for Same-Sex Couples.
Yes, it could be.
But and you specialize, and I know you've done lots of research.
Specifically with lesbian couples.
Right. Well, let's start talking a little bit about the book. You call it Same-Sex Couples instead of Lesbian Couples. First of all, why did you do that?
Yes, I've been asked about that a lot. That was an effort to be more inclusive. There are plenty of women who have sex with women who don't identify as lesbian. Some women identify as bisexual.
Mm-hmm.
Some women identify with, you know, this idea of sexual fluidity that you hear more about recently. And, you know, some women don't want to be stereotyped. But, you know, in the official epidemiological research, it's described as women who have sex with women. But I thought same-sex accomplished the same purpose, and as a, you know, I want to be inclusive, because people have also said this book could be written as sexual intimacy for women, because also straight women really relate to a lot of this, too. So I think it's for all of us.
Sure. And, you know, it was just one of those things that just kind of hit me, for same-sex couples instead of for lesbian couples. But I understand exactly what you're saying there. I also found interesting in the book, I made my notes, because as I was reading it, I went along, made a bunch of notes. One of the things I like is, I'm looking for it, I'm flipping to it. Okay, on page 49, you have a whole bunch of things about, in your sexual intimacy workshops, you ask women to identify some of the ways that they've learned to avoid opportunities for sexual contact. Now, as I was going through this, it was, well, that's not just women, that is men and women. And I keep saying that because so many of my male friends were saying to me, well, how are you going to interview? Because these are just intimacy issues that we're talking about, really, not sexual issues.
Mm-hmm.
What do you find the number one reason that people... the number one reason that you find women avoid sex?
The number one way that we avoid?
Yeah.
I think the number one way is by saying to ourselves or possibly to our partners, I'm just not in the mood. Now, behaviorally, how that shows up as in getting busy with other things. Like, I think going online is one of the top three ways of avoiding opportunities, because, you know, when do you have a sexual opportunity? When you're home, and often late at night or early in the morning, so there aren't the other social distractions.
Yeah.
So the computer is a great way to go.
One way that I saw that, that's me, watching television in bed, because I turn on the TV and I fall asleep.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not an intentional thing. It's more of a, you know, turn the TV on till two people are ready, and then by the time you're both in bed, you're asleep.
Yeah. Well, and you know, there's another thing, too, that somebody actually here in Atlanta did a research, a little survey for all couples. It turns out that having pets sleep in the bed with you is a real deterrent to sexual intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people who had their dogs or cats sleeping with them had sex less often than people who don't. And I know some of my friends who are dog lovers might not like my saying that, but I have sure heard that a lot, too.
My last partner and I, when we found a dog who was just a little 8-week-old puppy, cute as could be, the first night we had her sleep downstairs, the second night she slept upstairs but in a box, and the third night she was in bed. And she had this way of burrowing her way in between us.
Right, yeah.
And that's exactly how that would happen.
Almost literally, yeah.
Literally. I mean, she would just get between us. She liked it nice and warm there. You also say getting on the computer or the telephone.
Yes.
Okay, so, Spencer, if you're listening, so you think texting during sex is not a good idea?
Well, I guess it depends on the kind of text, but...
It wasn't to me.
Okay. I would definitely say that texting to somebody else during sex is not a good idea.
Okay, Spencer.
Unless it's part of some kind of, I don't know, people have all kinds of arrangements that are funny for each other, but you know what I mean. No texting, of course not. I think you're being humorous here.
No, I'm not. The last time we went out to dinner, I took his phone from him. It was sitting on the table, which is an unusual place for it. It's usually in his hand. I took it, and I put it on the seat next to me. It took about 15 seconds for him to be, like, crawling up the walls.
Yeah.
And the agreement that we had during that dinner was, I will give you the phone back if you turn it off.
Right.
That way he was able to have it in his hand.
You know, it's surprising to me. The other day I talked with a woman who was doing some online dating and went to have dinner with the person first time. And turned out she was texting during dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And so this new person she met was a little offended. And this woman was kind of shocked, like, but it was only my family. It's Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wow, you really don't get it. That is not giving someone your undivided attention. That's attending somewhere else. And it's a big turnoff.
Well, I'm glad you said that. And if Spencer's listening, he might just... he might just get it.
Oh, okay. Well, if this is helpful, I'd be glad. But, the avoidance question, part of, you know, I ask that during workshops or in couples therapy because often we act like, you know, I'm perfectly willing to have sex. Oh, yes, I'm all into it. But then if you ask someone, if you consciously wanted to avoid that, how could you be sure that that happens? And that's when it gets funny when people come up, you know, people know exactly how to avoid it, but we tend to not be conscious of it, or at least tell ourselves that we're not conscious of it. And so part of why I ask people to really identify it consciously
mm-hmm.
is so that you'll know when you're doing it. And then, you know, if you really consciously want to avoid sex, at least know what you're doing. But what's difficult and what makes partners crazy is when one person's saying, oh, yes, I'm into it. But, I forgot. I just had to answer that email. And that's what, you know, can be really frustrating for
right.
the other person.
Exactly, Spencer. I know the book is Sexual Intimacy for Women, but I think that that's probably one of those things that laps over into sexual intimacy for men. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. And I know you haven't done research on it, Glenda, so I just don't want to put words in your mouth. We are talking about the book Sexual Intimacy for Women. It's by Dr. Glenda Corwin, and she's joining us from Atlanta. Patty just came into the studio, and the point of Patty, you're supposed to keep this on a more mature level than I ever could.
I try every week.
I know.
I don't know. The immaturity is a little more entertaining.
Oh, okay. Some people who think that women in same-sex relationships really aren't bothered by a lack of sexual intimacy. Now, that's not true. Or is it true with some?
That is absolutely not true. And I'm glad you asked that. You know, one of the questions I asked on this online survey I did a few years ago, the survey was sexual behavior pattern, lesbian sexual behavior pattern. And I asked, one of the questions was, how important do you think regular sexual contact is in an ongoing relationship? And 92% of the 400 women who took this survey said it was very important. And that was striking to me because I've also heard this, you know, idea that maybe women just really don't care that much about sex and it's no big deal and we're fine with being good friends and cuddling. And I can tell you that was not what I found on that survey and it's not what I hear from my clients or friends. What I don't want to be disrespectful, there are some women who really are pretty neutral about sex, and it's okay. And I absolutely can respect that as a viable choice. The problem comes in, though, often these women have partners who are not neutral about it. And so you get into that desire discrepancy, which does cause a huge problem for a lot of couples. But I think if two women are together, or two men, or, you know, a straight couple, whatever, are together and both partners are on the same page about sex and it's not that important, that's absolutely fine. You know, that works for them. But I would say for the vast majority of women that I know and have talked to, sexuality is important. They're just frustrated and don't know how to make that happen.
And really, then, if you have two people who aren't interested in sex, there still should be an intimacy there in their own way. And it might be in a non-sexual way.
Absolutely. I mean, we get into how do we define intimacy. In the survey I did some follow-up interviews on the telephone, some anonymous interviews with about 30 women from all over the country. It was great. They talked to me pretty openly. And when I asked them about this issue about, you know, is sex that important and how do you compare that to emotional intimacy, what they said was emotional intimacy is great and sex takes it to the next level. It takes it to a deeper level that really feels great, and it's what's special between the two of us that's different from my relationship with other friends who I may feel very emotionally intimate with. So, I think was your question, but should you be able to be intimate without sex? Or
That you were saying like 10% of these couples really don't have sexual relationships much, but that's okay as long as there's still an intimacy there. That might be what defines that couple.
Well, I think that's okay as long as they're both okay with it. And sure, you can be intimate in other ways, as long as you're both okay with it. Absolutely.
Right, and sexual behavior is not intimacy. I mean, it's two separate concepts.
Well, that's an excellent point. In fact, when the first time I did a talk about this book, someone asked me, is your title Sex and Intimacy, or is it Sexual Intimacy? Because I think this goes to your point. They can be different things. Yeah, sex can just be a physical act, and it can be a physically pleasurable act. And again, and maybe you could talk to me about this a little bit from a male perspective. I know the stereotype is that the sexual intimacy is more complicated and involved for women, that we are less able to compartmentalize.
And I think that probably is very true for men, that men can compartmentalize, that with a partner you would have sex that is very intimate, and the sexual intimacy is very much a part of the relationship, but you can certainly have a sexual relationship with somebody on a non-intimate way, that might be your relationship with somebody that you're just seeing, that... And that's okay. So, yeah, I think men can compartmentalize. Who's here in the studio also. Jesse, would you agree with that? And he's laughing, and he doesn't even want to comment on that.
I
think that's
that,
true.
I think it's just really important to be really non-judgmental about those things, because, it's not for me or any of us to judge what's okay for other people, including compartmentalizing sex, as long as you're being respectful and not coercing others.
Right, which is why I interviewed somebody for the newspaper that I write for, and she was talking about her topic is questions that couples can ask each other. And a lot of the questions revolved this, or several of the questions revolved around this, and what we got down to was, if a straight person is asking you this question about, how you can become intimate, I said, because men understand men, women understand women, the question is then to turn around to the straight couple or the straight person asking you and saying, but how do you have an intimate relationship with a man have an intimate relationship with a woman? You're so different. So I get this. In a way that I don't. I want to, we need to take a break in just a minute, but I want to get to one of the questions. Your publicist, Gail, who's a good friend of mine, and if you talk to her, say hi to her for me.
Okay.
One of her questions that she sent, and I'm going to reword this differently. Do lesbians have less sex than straight couples or gay men, and why do you think that is? I'm going to reword that as, well, of course, us men who are all sluts have a lot more sex. But do lesbian couples have more sex or less sex than straight couples, do you think?
Okay. Yeah. Did you want me to answer that now or after
sure,
the break?
Sure. No, we have another couple of minutes before the break.
I do think that we do, and I know this is a subject of a lot of debate. Some people don't agree with this, but I think there was a very definitive study in 83 that was the key national study that showed that lesbians were the least sexually active couples. I'll give you one statistic real quickly. After 10 years of being together, 67% of straight couples are having sex at least twice a month. And after 10 years together, only 15% of lesbian couples. So the difference between 67% and 15%, I think, is striking.
And that's just twice a month, huh?
Yeah.
And Jesse and I are sitting here horrified by that number.
Well, you know, in the literature, sex therapy literature, at least twice a month is considered normal, believe it or not. I think the national average is supposedly three times a month for straight couples. And, yeah, if you make twice a month or more, you're safe. You're in the normal zone in terms of what the sex therapists define as normal.
And those of us who have sex more than that?
Well,
I guess that's what makes an average.
Exactly, yeah, and you don't get put in any special category for having more sex than that. Maybe lucky, but not.
I'd be interested what the number might be today, though. 1983, studying any sort of GLBT issue at all has got to be very, very different than what you might find in 2010, soon to be 2011. For a number of subjects, you might have stepped forward who are going to be open and honest about responding.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're right. And I do have a couple other sources of data that I would like to talk about this more because I'd like to talk about that subgroup of lesbians who are sexually active.
Why don't we take our break then, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. We're talking to Dr. Glenda Corwin. Her book is Sexual Intimacy for Women. We'll be back with more Lambda Weekly right after this.
Okay. Next time you search the web, raise money for KNON while you're at it. Now available, it's the new KNON 89.3 toolbar. Add it for free to your web browser, and each time you search the internet, KNON receives a donation. You can shop in more than 1,300 online stores, and a percentage of your purchase will automatically be donated to KNON at no cost to you. The toolbar provides coupons as well. To get your KNON toolbar and open up ways to search and save while supporting great community radio, go to the KNON website at knon.org and get yours now. Pass the toolbar along to all of your friends. The 2 minutes it takes to add this toolbar to your browser can make a difference for KNON. Get the toolbar now at knon.org.
You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM HD1 in Dallas and Fort Worth, the voice of the people.
And welcome back to Lambda Weekly. I'm David Taffet here in the studio with Patty Fink. Jesse Garcia is also sitting in with us today. Our guest is Dr. Glenda Corwin. Her book is Sexual Intimacy for Women. Okay, we were talking about a study that you wanted to talk more about.
Sure. It's the about the question of are lesbians less sexually active than straight couples? And someone in your studio brought up very accurately the point that things have probably changed a lot in 30 years since the original study was done. And I think they have. In my in that 1983 study, which is Bloomstein and Schwartz, it's kind of the classic University of Washington study, they found after 10 years together, 15% of lesbians were having sex at least twice a month, which, I mentioned is that's the cutoff for, quote, normal. And in the survey that I did, I also looked at couples who were together at least 10 years just to get a comparison. Of course, I didn't have the numbers they did, but still in my sample, I found about 20% were still having sex at least twice a month. So the difference between that 15 and 20% is not that great. It seemed to me from that subgroup is about the same. But I think that's a very positive subgroup. And what I wanted to focus on then and in the interviews after that was how were those women different from others who had stopped being sexual? And that led into, to me, the fascinating difference between the active and non-active long-term couples was there was just one question that differentiated the two groups, and that was the question, do you regularly plan time for sex? The active women were the planners, and the non-active women were not. And when I asked them about that, it was very interesting to me. The active women said, of course we plan time for sex, otherwise it would never happen, because we're so busy. The non-planners said, no, I can't do that. That would feel too awkward, and it needs to be spontaneous. And that, I think, that idea about spontaneity is a huge myth that's a real deterrent. And I know this is not just for women. I know it's a deterrent for straight couples, because they talk about it a lot.
And the difference for gay male couples is that we plan time to do something other than sex.
Okay. Okay. Can you say a little more what you mean?
That, yeah, we're going to have sex, but, oh, yeah, we do really need to, like, make dinner tonight.
Okay. So,
or yeah. We're going to go, you know, we've been just staying in too much. Let's go out and do whatever.
I think there's just a kind of a deterrent effect, though, if you think, oh, well, if I have to put it in my BlackBerry, mm-hmm. you know, that's a little, you know, distasteful.
It is. But here's the thing, I think. Yeah,
but, right. But if you're not, mm-hmm. I think it's better that you do that, isn't it?
Well, think about this. Think about what happens when you first start seeing somebody. Because we all think that initial stage in a new sexual relationship is exciting. Mm-hmm. And we tend to think it's the novelty. But think about the amount of planning that you do. If you've got a date on Saturday night, you usually start thinking about it, and you start thinking about sex days ahead of time. In fact, I like to call it 24-hour foreplay, because you're thinking, I'm going to have this hot date Saturday night. What am I going to wear? What kind of underwear am I going to wear? Where are we going to go? Is the lighting going to be flattering? What kind of activities are we going to do? If it's dancing, you know, that's physical, that puts you in touch with your body. Things like that. And then we plan for privacy, tell our friends, don't call after 10 o'clock, I'll be busy. We do a tremendous amount of planning for sex, and then it happens, and then we go, wow, that felt so spontaneous. But I think we really underestimate how much very deliberate planning we do in the early stages of a relationship, and then later we stop doing it and say, where did the romance go? But I think the real question is, where did the romantic behaviors go? Now, and I realize, you know, I'm talking here more to couples who've been together for a while. I know that there is a stimulating effect and novelty that there's no question that's true for all of us. It's true worldwide. But, you know, by definition, you can't have novelty in a long-term relationship. So then I think it's in our best interest to look at what are we doing for foreplay? What are we doing to get ourselves in the mood and get our partners in the mood? And doing it, you know, at least 24 hours ahead of time, thinking about it.
Right. And like you said, you're talking about long-term relationships because mm-hmm. those things are more natural in at the beginning of a relationship.
Sure.
Or as I call them, short-term relationships.
Well,
or my relationships.
Well, you have plenty of company, believe me.
I know.
Yeah. In a short-term relationship, I mean, in the beginning of a relationship, we do an awful lot of stuff that goes to what sex therapists call creating positive anticipation.
And what is that?
Well, that's actually their definition of sexual desire. Positive anticipation means thinking about sex and how good it's going to feel. You know, a phrase, I can't tell you how many times I've heard this from women. I can't speak. I'd love to know your perspective as a man. Mm-hmm. A lot of women say about sex, Once it gets started, it feels great. It's the getting started part. A lot of straight women say that, too. Yeah, once I'm into it, I love it, but it's the getting started.
Oh, that's interesting. I've never thought of it that way.
Well,
I think men usually think of it as something yeah, it's going to be great. Let's just get going.
Well, we often talk about it. It's like riding a bicycle, but if you never get the bike, then you can't, you know, say, oh, yeah, I remember this.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and if you never really thought about the things that you do to get yourself in the mood, then it you're not going to know what to do. And again, that goes back to the idea of foreplay, in that there's usually three things when people break it down that go into planning for sex. You know, one of them is, of course, for women, trying to get your emotional connection kind of in sync. You know, check with your partner, how are you doing, how's your week been, or something, just get in touch a little bit. And one of them, another one is getting some kind of sensual awareness going. Like, an awful lot of women on this survey told me that they love to do things like yoga ahead of time, because yoga lets you get into your body and appreciate how you feel without judging yourself, which, you know, body image, I know this is true for men too, it's a huge issue if you're outside looking, judging yourself instead of being into it. So, again, for part of foreplay, a lot of women said doing something like yoga is great because it lets me appreciate my own body, feel sensual feelings without judging. And then the third thing that a lot of, I think, is always involved in some foreplay is erotic imagination. That's, you know, when you're imagining what the images are going to look like. What's it going to look like when she takes her clothes off, or he? How's that going to feel? You're kind of living it in your erotic imagination. And then for other people, that goes into thinking about things that are stimulating. Again, we have to be non-judgmental. There's a variety of things that people like to think about that get them turned on. And that, to me, is part of foreplay.
I think it's very interesting, and I'm just saying this as like your average American observer.
As a woman.
Well, just as an observer. You watch television in recent, I would say even within the last year, maybe even two, but I think even tighter than that, lots of focus on female sexuality.
Yes.
There's ads for, you know, lubrication and vibrators and, you know, and even medications now designed to enhance the female sexual experience. And I've never seen that before on television. There's a lot of things I've never seen before on television, but that's one of them that sort of crept into the norm, so to speak, in our national conversation. That it's there, and we've, you know, years ago they discovered this drug called Viagra, and, you know,
right.
That's, now we have all kinds of permutations of that. But this is fairly new for women.
Yes, it is. And I mean, it's such an interesting point, because some people think that a lot of this is just driven by the pharmaceutical industry. That, first of all, let's set the scene to make women feel bad about themselves if they're not feeling all this sexual energy. And then we'll sell them a drug to make them more interested in sex. I was thinking about this the other day. It's almost like, in terms of looking at female sexual desire, which is a huge issue. In the old days, old days, I guess, women weren't supposed to be that interested in sex. It was supposed to be a male domain. And then, fortunately, you know, we kind of corrected that and acknowledged, yeah, women have sexual feelings too. But at times, I think with the media images that you were describing on TV and so forth, we've almost gone to the other end of, you know, women are supposed to be really sexual and have a lot of sexual desire, and if you don't, there must be something wrong with you. So it's like you're pathological if you're not feeling a lot more sexual interest. And in the old days, you were pathological if you were. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And the issue about that I think is really important is, this is another research area that's very interesting on female sexual desire and what is a normal level. And I think that we have compared ourselves to male models of sexual desire in the past. And this is, of course, stereotyping, but in general, it appears that men have about 10 times as much testosterone as we do. So, of course, you're more interested in sex. Again, generalizing, or rather feel more of that physiological drive.
Is one of the reasons that a heterosexual couple would tend to have more sex than a lesbian couple because one of the partners in the heterosexual couple is a male?
Yes, that is true. And, yet, you know, there's some interesting data about that, because it turns out as people get older, and I've sure seen this in my practice too, when there's a lack of sex in a heterosexual marriage or a heterosexual, very often it's men who stop having sex. And particularly as they get older, women are usually the ones who are saying, what can we do to bring sexuality back into the relationship? I think that's because sexual desire is broader than just sex drive. You know, sex drive is a physiological kind of thing. It probably is very tied to testosterone. But desire has more to do with motivation, with knowing knowing that what sex can bring to a relationship, with the emotional closeness and the intimacy aspect, where sexual excitement and love and intimacy are connected. And I think that's what women get more and more interested in as they get older. The research about female sexual desire per se, there was another huge study done in 2003 in about 25 different countries, so this isn't just a cultural bias. And what they found, and other studies since then have found, is that if you just ask women in terms of sex drive or physiological urges to have sex, about 50% at least of women say they really don't have much. In other words, these are the women who get diagnosed as having, quote, low sex drive,
mm-hmm.
and turn it into a clinical diagnosis. And then this is where people say, the pharmaceutical industry loves that, because if we can label women as having a problem, then we can sell them a remedy for it. But what I think a comprehensive way of looking at it is, yeah, many women don't feel much physiological urge to have sex, but we still really like to have sex because we know what it brings to the relationship. And we know, going back to once we get started, it feels great. We may not have that initial drive to get it started, but once we do, it feels great. And I know I went a long way from your statement that in a straight couple, often men, you know, drive the relationship because of more interest.
Yeah, and I was going to say, as I've gotten older, the way I've cured that is I just date younger men.
Well,
rationalize all you want, David.
Okay. One of the things I really like about the book is that at the end of several sections of it, you have a section called Your Turn. And in Your Turn, what that is things that people can do themselves, questions they can ask themselves, other things that they can do to help their relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And here's one of them. In your primary relationship, who seems to have the most sexual desire? So that's very normal for one person in the couple to have more sexual desire than the other, male or female couple.
Absolutely.
What are some of the things, if one of the persons in the relationship or one of the women in your book has more of a desire, what are some things that she can do to interest her partner?
Mm-hmm. Okay, great question. First of all, I think in every couple, one person has more desire than the other. Just like in every couple, one person is usually taller than the other.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and I like the way you put that, because it's just a characteristic. It's not something right, wrong, anything. It's just a characteristic.
I think sometimes it shifts.
I'm sorry?
I think sometimes it shifts.
It shifts.
Not the height.
Yeah. Right. Not
Patty
the,
will
not
always
the height,
be short.
Right. My partner's very tall, and I'm very short. But that doesn't shift. But I'm thinking, you know.
Mm-hmm. The sexual desire.
Yeah. The one having more or less. You know, that shifts around.
Oh, you're yeah, absolutely it can shift. It's just that at any given point in time, usually one is more than the other. Occasionally, exactly the same. But, yeah, it's not that it's a fixed role, that one's always high desire and one's always low desire. But just, there's usually some difference there. And I guess, so for starters, in terms of what the higher desire person can do, one is to get really clear that having less desire does not mean that your partner is in any way has anything wrong with her. There's nothing wrong with her. There's nothing weird. And it doesn't mean there's something wrong with your relationship. It just means you're on a slightly different wave level at this point. And I can't overemphasize how important it is to start from that, not pathologizing the other, because this is what I hear couples do all the time. They either can, if there's a discrepancy in desire, sometimes the higher desire person is gets into sort of blaming the other, like, what's wrong with you? Or they can get into shaming the other person, like, I think you have some deep psychological disturbance. Or they can get into their own shame. There's something wrong with me. You're not attracted to me. What am I doing wrong? So to just stop all of that shame and blame stuff and just stay with this is just a normal difference is an essential first step. After that, I think the next step is really communication in a real non-judgmental way. And this is part of why I put those questions at the end of the chapters in, to help people have a way to talk sometimes. Like, you can read this question, highlight it, and talk to your partner about it. Like, what do you think about this question? What is something that helps you get more in the mood? When I do workshops, I have people fill out these questionnaires, and one of the questions is, or one of the fill-ins is, things that I do to get myself in a sexual mood, and then the other one is things that you can do to help me get in a sexual mood. And then I ask people to just read them to each other. You know, don't discuss it or comment on it, but just read it. Like, so if you're the high desire person and want to help your partner be interested more, ask him or her, what are some things that I do that help you feel more interested in sex with me? And then be careful to listen and take what that person says very literally. I think those are the two most important parts in dealing with that discrepancy and desire, being non-judgmental about it and then just asking. And, of course, follow through on what the person says.
And do you think men are just more direct than women about certain things? Like, my way of handling it is, Spencer, turn the phone off or I'm going to break it. But do you think women have trouble discussing things? Because you think of women as being more expressive than men.
I think, in some ways we are more expressive. I think we have more trouble saying exactly what we want. And I think women are very sensitive. Not that men are insensitive, okay, but I think women are very sensitive to each other's feelings and worry a lot about not hurting somebody.
Mm-hmm.
So that a statement like, if you don't turn the phone off, I'm going to break it over your head. I think a woman might have a little trouble saying that.
Right. And it's not Spencer, it's the phone.
I know. Yeah, no, I think that...
Spencer and I, by the way, are not dating anymore.
Oh, you're not?
Oh, not anymore. No.
Oh.
Yeah,
well.
Yeah. We're still good friends, though.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm sure he still wants to break that phone.
I do still want to break the phone sometimes when I see him, but no, we are not dating. The image is that women just are more expressive, but do women have a lot of trouble discussing intimacy-type things? Patty is kind of shaking her head here, or nodding a little bit.
You mean intimacy, or do you mean sex?
Well, sexual intimacy-type things, both, as they're related to each other.
Yeah, you know, I think lesbians are famous for processing things to death, or at least this is what one of my gay male friends tells me, that he's actually an honorary lesbian because he likes to process so much.
Well, and there's that Roberts rule, you know, that says life is a process, lesbian life is the process of processing the process.
Okay. I have not heard that, but it's good, yeah. Yeah, there can be paralysis by analysis. Mm-hmm. There can be endless going on about the meaning of this or that.
We need to take a break. We're talking to Dr. Glenda Corwin. Her book is Sexual Intimacy for Women. And for our regular male listeners, I think this is good, too. These really are things that I think apply to both. I'm enjoying this. Glenda, stay with us. We just need to take another quick break. You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM.
KNON thanks you for your pledge to our recent pledge drive. Now's the time to make your pledge count. Send your pledge to KNON, P.O. Box 710909, Dallas, Texas 75371. If you missed our pledge drive, you can still support community radio by pledging on the web at knon.org. Your pledge only counts if you pay it. KNON, Box 710909, Dallas, Texas 75371. Be sure to put the name of the show you are supporting on the check, money order, or the envelope. Questions about KNON's pledge drive? Call 214-828-9500, extension 234.
You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM HD1 in Dallas and Fort Worth, the voice of the people.
And you're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM. I'm David Taffet here in the studio with Patty Fink, and we are talking to Dr. Glenda Corwin. Her book is Sexual Intimacy for Women. Patty, during the break, you made a comment.
I was just talking about, you know, you just don't see, you know, men tend to have more casual relationships. And my partner, I have to credit my partner Erin with this because it's her observation. She says that men have casual sex to avoid masturbation, and what women have masturbate to avoid casual sex. And I think that's very true among men, because you see, particularly in a lot of gay male relationships, a very committed relationship, and yet it's open, and they may have sex with other guys. But you don't see that really in female couples. I mean, we don't really see, we don't see, like, female or lesbian prostitution out there. It's just no market for it.
It doesn't exist out there.
Because it's not something that women seek out.
Yeah, and Glenda, in your book, you talk about fidelity as being something that's more than monogamy.
Yes. Well, and that's a really loaded issue these days. A number of people I talk to ask me, well, what are you saying about polyamorous relationships? You know, and like the person who just spoke, I'm sorry, I'm blocking your name.
That was Patty.
Patty, okay. Yeah. I think you're absolutely right that we don't hear about lesbian prostitution and so forth. And I don't think many women are comfortable with relationships outside of the primary one, because, you know, sex is more, it does seem to be more complicated, less compartmentalized, and more about our relationship. But I have to say, I have known in my lifetime a couple situations where people lived a long time in a polyamorous arrangement, and I know that they were faithful to each other in the sense of being true to the spirit of their relationship. They're very committed. The three of them were committed to each other and very respectful of each other, and were not at all dishonest about what the nature of how free they were, available they were to other people. So that's, you know, monogamy to me is kind of a very legalistic thing, like sex with only one person, and I think that is, for most of us, the ideal and works great. But there are, and we know in the gay male community, I mean, again, here's what I'm hearing. Actually, I've heard a majority of long-term gay male couples have some kind of arrangement that allows for some sexual exploration outside the primary relationship, but usually with, you know, some pretty clearly defined rules and ways to respect each other about that. So I think it's, that's what I'm saying. I think it's possible to be faithful to your partner, and sometimes have arrangements that step outside of traditional monogamy.
You know, you were just speaking about the polyamorous relationships, mm-hmm. and a few that you've known where you've been, I guess three you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
I've been a lesbian all my life, and I've never met any couple like that.
Yeah.
Ever. I mean, I know men who you know, have relationships mm-hmm. where it's mutual consent, where they step outside the relationship from time to time, but it's not where it's a, you know, three people. I mean, it's
yeah.
one stepping out with someone not in the relationship. But I've never really known that. Anyway, that's interesting.
Yeah, and let me clarify that. In my entire life, I've known two. It wasn't eight. You, it's just two.
Okay.
yeah. No, I. And even those two, most people don't believe me, but so, no, it's extremely rare. And, I don't quite see how they do it, but.
And this is in one of your other My Turns that I really like. You say if your partner's been unfaithful, how do you decide what to do about it? And here we're talking about unfaithful in terms of outside the rules and boundaries of your relationship.
Right.
And you say, could the investment model help you analyze what you've put in, how much you still love her, and how likely you are to find something better? In other words, when you're investing, you've put something in, now you need to get something out of it. Are you getting out of it what you expected when you put in what you did. Mm-hmm. Explain that a little bit more in maybe better terms than I'm explaining it right now.
You mean like ROI?
Return, like, return on, yeah. What is the return on investment? What does that really mean? What types of things?
I think possibly looking at this from a slightly different angle, the investment model was originally developed to help understand how do some women decide whether or not to leave an abusive relationship? And so I was kind of extrapolating from that to this. Meaning, how much you've invested, usually that's talking about, I can think of a woman who came to my office and said, I've spent 12 years with my partner. All our money is tied up together. We own a house together. We have these joint investments. And it's a lot, and I hate to walk away from that. On the other hand, there had been infidelity, and she was considering it. So it's investment from that. Just what are you willing to give up if you feel like the emotional bond has been broken with this person?
But that would be different than, at first you mentioned abuse. Mm-hmm. In an abusive relationship, somebody needs to get out of that.
Oh, there's no question that someone needs to get out of it, but there's also no question that many women do stay in abusive relationships because they can't afford to get out.
Oh.
We can't underestimate the economic. I mean, that's a tragic situation, but... I remember talking to someone years ago, a woman who... her former husband used to batter her, and she said when she figured out she needed to get out, but she had two small kids, that she decided to go to nursing school, and she planned it out. It took her 2 years to get in a situation where she could afford to leave him. And that meant two more years of handling the abuse. But to her, that was the best option. And she did get out, and I've always respected her for that. So that's a little away from the...
And you're talking about a plan to get out, which is better than apologizing for the partner who's abusive, and we're getting onto a completely different topic here. But and that has nothing to do with intimacy, but what I wanted to do was be clear that you're really not talking about, with intimacy, we're not talking about abusive, we're talking about in a relationship where there are just differences in how you approach each other.
Mm-hmm.
And what some of the rules are. Would one of the approaches on the return on investment model, would one of the approaches be, well, I really do like what I get out of this relationship, so maybe we need to redefine the rules so that we're both happy?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Either that, redefine the rules, or for some couples, and I think in the majority of lesbian relationships, when there's some infidelity, the relationship usually does not last. Apparently, in the majority of heterosexual marriages, if the husband is unfaithful, the marriage usually does last. If the wife is unfaithful, it usually does not. I'm going off topic here a little bit, but
that's interesting, though. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering why if the woman is unfaithful, the relationship doesn't last.
Well,
since we know he's been unfaithful too.
Yeah.
Men are pigs.
No, that's not. The explanation that's usually given for that is two things. One is women are more likely to be economically dependent on their husbands, so they have more to lose.
Mm.
And the other is that we do understand that men compartmentalize sex more, so that it doesn't have the, may not have the devastating impact. Nobody likes to know their partner cheated on them, but...
So actually, the bar is lower because just expect it. It's like, well, I can't help it.
Well, that would be one way to put it. And the other kinder way is for some women to say, I understand that was just about sex.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wouldn't buy that for a minute, okay? I wouldn't accept that, but that is what some women say.
But well, that is more of a guy thing.
Mm-hmm.
But there's sort of another angle to it. I mean, if a woman's been unfaithful, is she leaving that husband in order to go into a new relationship? Not because she says, hey, I see something better out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that's very different from, I don't want to be with you. It's more like, I want to be with him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and that probably is part of why, yes, when a woman is unfaithful, it is more likely to end. Because she's more likely to already have an emotional involvement with somebody else that she wants to go
mm-hmm.
to.
One of the other your turns is think about how your own early family life affected your expectations about sexuality in the context of a family. What do you mean by that?
Oh, well, I have to say that personally, I think about my parents when I was a kid, and I feel very lucky in this way. I always knew that they knew that there was something between them that was separate from the kids, separate from the family, that there was some kind of romantic energy there. It was not inappropriate. It wasn't overtly expressed or anything like that. But I just knew from an early age that there was something that a couple had together, sexuality, and in the way that I was told about it, that it was something very, very positive between, of course, in other words, you know, the sanctity of holy matrimony or marriage between one man and one woman, whatever, but that it was a positive thing. And an awful lot of people I know didn't learn that from their parents. They either didn't hear any sexual messages at all, or there was animosity between the parents, mm-hmm. or more often just the sex wasn't talked about. And so that's what I think the... and this is something I think in our culture now, because we as a culture tend to be so child-focused, I think that we're losing something really important here, and those of us in, you know, gay relationships who have kids need to remember this too. You know, the best thing for your kids, they say, is the best gift you can give your children is to let them know you love their other parents.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we provide a model for our kids that, you know, you can grow up and have your own loving sexual relationship that's between the two of you that doesn't get lost in that whole, you know, family focus. So,
well, I think too, there are often a lot of partners out there who, in couples, who may feel uncomfortable with like public displays of affection. Mm-hmm. You know, like if when Erin and I might meet after work and we're going to have dinner or something, I go in and I usually give her a very quick kiss and sit down at the table, and it's normal. And I know other couples who would just freak to do that in front of anybody, or one in the couple maybe, mm-hmm. and not others, and that's because they didn't really see or accept.
Yeah.
You know, there could be a lot of issues behind that, but of course, but I think that's one big thing too. And of course, straight people say, you know, if we do that little bitty peck, that we're flaunting it, mm-hmm. you know, so fraught with issues.
Yeah, well, it is fraught with issues, and I'm sure not talking about, I didn't say any long, passionate tongue kissing or anything like that.
No, I think what we're really talking about is if you come from a family where your parents were affectionate, where they held hands when you went out. If you're from a family where your parents like each other. I mean, I come from a family, we virtually have no divorce in our family, mm-hmm. other than me. But all of my cousins, all of my aunts, uncles, are all on their one and only marriage. So that's the family, that's what I project as being the norm. If you have somebody who comes from something different, intimacy is different. It's not meant to be long term, necessarily. When my father, and this is going to heterosexual couples, but after my mother died, my father remarried while he was dating. He preferred dating other widows because they understood better. He didn't like dating people who had been divorced because he really didn't feel secure with them, which I thought was interesting. But that's that same sort of. Does your intimacy patterns do your intimacy patterns mesh?
Mm-hmm.
You talk a little bit about, and Laurent, our other co-host, isn't here today, and he's a parent of a 2-year-old. He has a sore throat today, and I'm sure it's from Thanksgiving weekend where they went on a long, long drive with a screaming 2-year-old in the car.
Clearly, Ron's still recovering.
I think he is still recovering from that because that sure wore him out. But you talk a little bit about women who have parents, who have children, women, same-sex couples,
yeah.
who have children. Talk a little bit about that and how that affects the relationship and affects intimacy.
Well, it's not positive, but I think we need to talk about it so we can try to make it better. On my survey. One of the questions that I asked was, are there children under the age of 18 living in your home?
Mm-hmm.
And I could tell you, of the women who said yes to that, none of them had sex in the last year.
Hmm.
Zero. And than among the couples I know who've had children. There's a tremendously high breakup rate within a year or two after that. And by the way, in the heterosexual research, what they've pointed out is that the arrival of the first child, there is a 70% decrease in marital satisfaction. I don't know how they compute these percentages, always, but there's a huge decrease in marital satisfaction when kids arrive, which is terrible because, you know, children are supposed to be a natural next step and something you do together. And of course, there are, you know, there are that 30% of couples who are really happy and grow together as a couple. But a lot of loss of sexual interest, and some people say the first child, it takes a big hit, and the second child, it totally disappears. So I think we just need to be realistic. Children are wonderful. But we need to be realistic about the pressures on the relationship and take real specific steps to try to get some help so that you and your partner can still have a relationship with just each other, you know, and have somebody else take the kids for the weekend or one friend of mine I talked to who does have children with her partner, and she said, you know, the only way that we can have sex is to go out of town, and I have to be at least 60 miles away before I can start to feel romantic.
Oh, that's terrible.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, from the male couples that I know who've had children, I don't think it's... I'm sure they're sexually they are not having the same intimate they're not having the same relationship that they were having before, but I think Danny and Laurent are as close as ever. I mean, they're talking about another child, you know, and that was a very romantic, just Laurent and Danny and their lesbian surrogate, and they made a baby the first time and it worked, and but I think that's brought them closer.
Yeah. You know, this would be a great research study because I bet you're right. I bet this is more a lesbian problem. And I've heard some people say for lesbians, when we have kids, it really just taps into some mother stuff that's just too intense. Or that maybe we get into this terrific feeling of responsibility and obligation for the baby to the point that, you know, we really shut our partners out of it. I'm not sure. I would love to see somebody do a study on the different effects of parenting on gay men and on lesbian couples.
Well, I think for all parents too, there's an issue of privacy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you have a child, you oftentimes have those monitors, and you're listening for the baby, any possible sound, and you don't want to distract from that. And you know, as they get older, then they can just burst into the bedroom and.
Any time, day or night,
and you know, they walk in while you're in the shower, and. You know, I mean, there's a different set of boundaries happening.
Oh, thank you for bringing it back to an extremely practical point. Yes, that's probably the biggest thing is the lack of privacy.
Right.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, we are out of time. I want to thank you for being on with us. The book is Sexual Intimacy for Women, A Guide for Same-Sex Couples by Dr. Glenda Corwin. And all of my friends who all week were thinking that this would be the most immature interview that I have ever done, I think we did fine.
Oh, I think this was great. Thank you so much for having me, and I don't think you sound immature at all.
Oh, thank you. She obviously doesn't know me real well.
High compliment.
It is. It is. And we'll be back next week with more Lambda Weekly. Our guest next week is Dennis Coleman from Equality, Texas.
Thank you, Dr. Korn.
Thank you so much. Bye.
You're listening to KNON 89.3 FM, Dallas-Fort Worth.
Hey, it's polka time!
Well, what do you know?
What do you know?